This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And here we are once again. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. How are you doing today, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Questions come to us via radio program at AOL.com. That's the destination for questions that we'll use as fodder for our weekly Q&A sessions. And we got a lot of good ones this week.
We do.
Shall we proceed to questions, or is there anything in the news of importance?
I've not seen much of anything in the news on the nutrition or health and wellness front. Lately.
No, not lately. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me see if I've seen anything that caught my eye this week. It's quieted down a little bit. You did a nice article on what's causing my heart palpitations.
Yes.
What do you talk about there?
I talk about unstable blood sugar. I talk about food allergies because the palpitations begin after they eat. Mm-hmm. They're fine as long as they don't eat.
And you know about this old-fashioned thing called the COCA pulse test?
Yes.
You remember that?
Yes.
It was like sort of a thing from the 70s, I believe, mm-hmm. where a doctor named COCA, they asked him, how do you test for food allergies? Do you use a blood test? I mean, they're unreliable. You know, how do you determine if someone has a food allergy? And he said, I have people eat a food, mm-hmm. and then a few minutes later, I do a baseline pulse, and then I do a pulse after the person has had the food. I don't know what the duration is. And in patients who had a reaction, they actually had a mm-hmm. nervous system reaction, like
yes.
a sympathetic nervous system reaction.
Yep.
So that's, I guess, part of the basis of your article. Read mm-hmm. it on Facebook. I, last week, took out to the woodshed Consumer Reports for highly inaccurate reporting about the 15 supplements that you should never take. They included green tea extracts, which are among my favorite supplements.
Unbelievable.
And what it boils down to, I mean, you can read it, but basically, on the basis of the scantest evidence of, you know, maybe a handful of reports of toxicity, mm-hmm. They indicted a supplement which is extremely valuable. So read that article on Facebook. If you didn't catch it there, you can go to drhoffman.com. And that's where we post all our articles. And you'll find Layla's article there as well.
You know, I would advise everyone to just rely on Consumer Reports when you're buying your next dishwasher.
If that, it casts aspersions on their ability to, come up with accurate reporting on consumer mm-hmm. Issues. Of course, this has been a big week for the World Cup. Right?
Ah.
And this, I dug an article from 2006 in the New England Journal of Medicine, which mm-hmm. states that in 2006, the World Cup was held in Germany, which is mm-hmm. like fanatical soccer fans. And it turned out that the rate of cardiovascular events was three times higher among men during the World Cup soccer matches.
Spectating men.
Mm-hmm. Not
the players.
Not participants. Yeah, they're in great cardiovascular condition.
Yeah.
But so beware of, you know, when you shout, goal!
Yeah. Oh, bravo! You did it.
Of course, a lot of breath control. But
bravo.
It's like that broadcaster, training that, you know.
Yes.
Go from the diaphragm. And I love this one. More proof the gut mediates brain function.
Oh, yeah.
We know that there's a gut-brain connection. Mm-hmm. So in an astonishing study, this just knocks my socks off. They took patients with bipolar disease, and they had episodes of mania which caused them to be hospitalized.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty serious. And we've had patients with mania, and, you know, sometimes they
they go off their meds. And, mm-hmm. you know, just like in, you ever watch Homeland?
Yes.
You know, Claire Danes, mm-hmm. You know, what's the character she plays?
For crying out loud. Okay. Carrie Mathison.
So the whole plot is, it's actually tedious because she's always going nuts, you know.
She plays that part very, yeah, very yeah. well.
But she does a
good job. Acting.
Anyway, yeah. she goes off her meds because she yes. is more creative when she goes off her meds.
She's able to do her job better.
Right. And we find that, actually, I've seen that in some patients with bipolar disorder. They feel kind of muted on the meds, so sometimes yeah. they go off their meds. And when they go off their meds, they can go off the rails. So anyway,
yeah.
Patients hospitalized with episodes of mania. They took 66 patients, divided them into two groups, 33 and 33. One group got a control placebo. Mm-hmm. Another group got a certain probiotic. And what they found is that they dramatically reduced the incidence of rehospitalization in these patients.
Wow.
Now, what's interesting is that those patients were not just taking probiotics. They didn't say just take probiotics.
They take it in addition to your lithium.
To your lithium or to whatever meds they were taking, powerful medications to suppress bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
And what they... So this is just mind-blowing, is that probiotics can exert such a powerful influence, not just on mild mood problems or, you know, like mild depression, you feel a little better. I'm talking really serious.
I'm elated.
Duty.
You know what? I'm elated about that news.
Okay. So did you take your meds?
I'm manic about this news because there's so much more mental illness lately. Mm-hmm. You have to wonder.
Yeah.
Maybe it's the advent of antibiotics and the messing with our microbiota
yes.
and the need yeah. for these probiotics. That's why I'm elated.
And there's a big controversy about bipolar disorder among children.
Oh.
You know, this notion that children could have bipolar disorder is relatively new. And it also corresponds to the introduction of newer, more powerful medications that received an indication that they're okay to use in children, which is a bonanza for the pharmaceutical industry. So some incredible statistic of children, like a substantial single-digit percentage of children are now being diagnosed with bipolar disorder, which I guess in a child manifests as like extreme tantruming, uncontrolled behavior. And so imagine, you know, if the microbiome were involved with some of these kids, you know, just as we suspect in ADD and autism.
Right, right. Oh, my goodness.
Anyway, little tangent. Mm-hmm. Just wanted to go over some of the big stories of the week. Let's get to questions, please.
Okay, we've got an email from Gabriella. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, just when I thought I was doing well with a hemoglobin A1C of 5.1, which, by the way, is pretty good. Hemoglobin A1C is an average marker of blood sugar over about a 12-week period. Hers at a 5.1 is pretty good.
Excellent.
Optimal is definitely around the 5 range.
Right. Yeah.
Gabriella says, I find that the thinking has changed. According to new guidelines released from the American College of Physicians, we should aim for levels of 7 and 8% based on evidence of 5 major trials. Going below 7 does not provide benefit. And we should clarify that Gabriella is talking about diabetics. If she has an A1C of 5.1, clearly,
right.
to us, she doesn't have diabetes. Well,
I think she's failing to distinguish between studies of diabetics.
Yes.
And usually, I actually think that this is more about type 1 diabetics, if I'm not mistaken.
Ah.
This is 78,000 Medicare participants with diabetes who are 65 and older and lived in 10 states. And so what they found is that, playing glucose limbo or hemoglobin A1C limbo is a bad idea because tight control means more medications with their inherent side effects or more insulin.
Yes.
And more insulin, the more your insulin, the higher your insulin, the more you get atherosclerosis and cardiovascular disease.
Yeah.
And the more obese you become.
Yes. And the more insulin, the more likelihood of hypoglycemia.
Exactly.
Insulin shock.
Right.
These are very...
Which can cause disorientation,
yes.
falls, accidents,
seizures
yeah.
at the worst.
Yeah. Yeah. So what they then said... So let me see with a bit of this article.
So, yeah. Gabriella is saying that furthermore, according to these studies... Those with A1C levels below 6.5 had a higher risk of death from heart disease than those who were between 7 and 8. Should I start gorging on Twinkies, Dr. Hoffman?
No, because it's Well, another way of saying this, it's not how low you go, it's how you get there. And if you get, if you're not on medication,
yeah,
and if you get there via diet and lifestyle, you know, lower the better.
Yeah.
Lower the better. Because it actually, some studies have shown that for every 0.1 of hemoglobin A1C above 5.6, I think it is, mm-hmm. there's a 10% greater risk of dementia.
Oh.
And so that is, even in that intermediate range, which we consider anywhere from 5.8 to 6.2, which is thought to be metabolic syndrome, pre-diabetes,
yes.
Not crossing the borderline of diabetes, which right. sometimes the cutoff is 6.2, sometimes 6.4,
mm-hmm.
That in that range, people come to harm, even if they're yeah. not diabetic.
Yeah.
Not formally diabetic.
Yeah.
So, I mean, great question.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it this study leads to a misleading conclusion.
It does.
Yeah.
It does. I do want to point out something, though. Sometimes, and especially in type 1 diabetics as well, as you mentioned, sometimes they have a new normal, whereas a blood sugar for you and me, a good normal blood sugar of, say, 75 would be just fine.
Yeah.
But for a type 1 diabetic, that might be quite hypoglycemic
right.
for them.
Right, exactly.
Because they may feel better at 98
right.
or 103.
Plus, they don't have a lot of running room there because if it's, you know, 78 could be a prelude to 45
yes.
pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So they need a little bit of a buffer against hypoglycemia,
mm-hmm.
which can be catastrophic,
mm-hmm.
you know. So we will tolerate higher levels. I mean, I have,
right.
you know, one of our diabetics is a young man, and I've been treating him ever since he became diabetic he was sort of an adolescent when I first saw him, and now he's a big, highfalutin lawyer. He's in his 30s. He's a mm-hmm. hotshot, but he still comes to me for management of his nutrition and diabetes. And, you know, he comes to me and he shows me his hemoglobin A1C and he's dismayed that it's like 7.2 or 7.0
mm.
and he wants to get it lower. And I said, you're a type 1 diabetic. That's really excellent. You will avoid end organ damage, you know, because yeah. you know, in a type 1 diabetic, if you let your hemoglobin A1C bounce around, you know, 10, 11, 12, you'll get eye problems, you'll get
sure.
heart problems, you'll get brain problems, you will
yeah.
get advanced glycosylation or advanced glycation end products
mm-hmm.
damaging your tissue, your kidneys.
You'll rust.
Yeah, you
yeah.
accelerated deterioration of your organs and, you know, mm-hmm. all the problems that type 1 diabetics get,
mm-hmm.
and, which limits their lifespan. So I don't know if I'll be around to treat him when he's in his 80s and 90s, but I hope he'll... Farewell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gabriella, thank you for your question. Your A1C is excellent at 5.1. Keep it there.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. We've got a question here from Karen. Is bone broth good to drink? I'm a distance runner from Special Olympics, New Jersey.
Okay.
Absolutely, it's great to drink.
As opposed to what, bathing in it?
As
opposed
to... Ooh, okay.
apply it topically to your sore muscles.
Right, yeah. right. No, bone broth.
I wouldn't
broth?
Recommend vaping it.
No. Drink your bone broth.
Right.
Sip it as a soup.
Well, you know, actually, there is a bit of a connection to this because, you know, one of the things that has been found with ultramarathoners, even marathoners, and very, very high-end athletes is they develop leaky gut syndrome.
Ah.
It actually is so... traumatic that they may have some mild ischemia of their gut or something, some form of stress that
yeah.
occurs through very high levels of exertion. And they may develop a direct disruption of their gut barriers.
Mm.
So that, you know, I would think that, and since bone broth is particularly helpful for restoration of the gut,
yes.
I would say that it's, you know, really not only okay,
yeah.
but recommended.
It's also good for restoration of your joints.
Yeah.
This is a distance runner.
Yeah, with the collagen.
So the collagen
yeah.
and all that
mm-hmm.
is very, very helpful.
And how you know that is that, you know, if you make your own bone broth, there's sort of, it's sort of a jelly when you put it, when you put
yes.
it in the refrigerator.
You're getting gelatin.
And it's, the gelatin is the collagen, building blocks.
Right.
Like Knox
right.
gelatin, which go,
it's good for you.
Preferentially to your joints.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so good.
It's good if you have arthritis as well. I highly recommend it. And I think, Karen, a good amount to take is at least a mugful a day is pretty good.
Yeah.
Of bone broth.
Do you have any favorite types, or do you make it on your
I'll
own?
I make it on my own.
There are commercial bone broths, which
yep.
may be, you know, maybe
Kettle
is
and
good.
Fire and
yeah.
Brothmasters,
mm-hmm.
two names that come to mind
right.
where you can get it. I'm seeing it a lot of grocery stores as well now.
Yeah.
In the frozen food section.
Yeah, it's all the rage. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is all the rage.
Paleo.
But it's easy enough to make your own.
Right.
Yeah. It's easy enough to make your own.
Well, you know, I rarely do I throw away chicken bones. You know, I just throw them in a crock pot and then just, you know, simmer those. Mm-hmm. And then I have my own homemade, and if it's high quality chicken, I get the good quality, you know, grass-fed or pasture-fed. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I also like to, when you make those cauliflower, so-called fake mashed potatoes, I like to cook that cauliflower in some bone broth or chicken broth. Before you take a potato masher to
it. I use that to cook, you know, sometimes I'll have lentils. I know it's not paleo, but I'm, you know, sometimes I'm looking for something a little different.
It's delicious with lentils.
Yeah, so you know, using that as a stock, and you know, to
or any kind of beef soup.
Steaming broccoli or something like that, you know, just gives it a little more flavor.
Yeah. Cook your quinoa in it. That's another good thing. Cook your rice in it.
Right.
Absolutely. Right. When you cook it in a flavorful broth, it's a brand new experience. And I find that quinoa needs some help. Unless it's the red quinoa, which is a little more flavorful.
I like that stuff. I actually was surprised. I kind of got back into quinoa.
Yeah.
Again, not strictly paleo, but why is quinoa thought to be a preferential grain to, say, bulgur? What is
higher protein. It's more classified as a seed or even a berry, but I think it's buckwheat that's a berry.
Less allergenic.
Less allergenic.
Less. What about lectin considerations? Is quinoa something that...
I'm more concerned about lectins and things like red kidney beans than anything else or something. Oh, and when you're cooking your beans, you likely don't want to cook them in a slow cooker, or at least don't cook them on slow rather than high. You want to be boiling them for at least a good 10 minutes to reduce those lectins.
Okay. And do you believe in soaking beans or like in throwing out the water?
Yes.
Or
so throw it out the water and you got your water and then cook it.
Okay.
Absolutely. If you're having beans.
Okay.
And bean soup in a beautiful bone broth or stock made from scratch, that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, I did none for like a really long time. Mm-hmm. But what I find is I'm a little bit more lenient on myself in the summer because I'm more active in the summer and it's more like more festive meals.
Yeah.
And, you know, so...
It's good to have some variety from time to time, too.
It's like I'll go off the rails and have some lentils.
Oh.
Whoa.
Lentils?
Yeah, I know it's like...
Oh, gosh. Okay, so Karen, thank you for your question. Drink that bone broth.
I had some wild rice the other day.
Yum.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got a question from Judy. I've heard that brushing vitamin E oil on your nails makes them less brittle. Hmm. Is that true? And would it affect someone on Coumadin?
Hmm.
Although I would not take it orally.
Hmm.
Thank you.
Oh, well, let's address that. You know, that's new to me. Have you heard of this?
No, but you know, you could take vitamin E, poke the soft gel, and put it on your skin and get a nice glow.
Hmm.
I think if Judy has brittle nails, I'd want to know what her iron levels are like first.
Yeah, other nutrients, zinc, and so on.
Right.
Yeah. Well, okay, so let's speak to the issue of, you know, I mean, of course, putting it on your nails, you're not going to absorb enough vitamin E to interfere with Coumadin.
Yeah.
I think a better question is, can you take vitamin E with Coumadin? And I'm perfectly fine with people taking vitamin E with Coumadin.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wouldn't take massive amounts. I wouldn't take 2,000 or 1,600 of vitamin E, but 200... maybe 400 international units of
that would suffice.
Of mixed tocopherols should not be a problem. It should not overly thin your blood. I mean, she's being, I think, overly cautious by worrying that the little vitamin E in her nails is going to get in a bloodstream and thin her blood to the point where she's going to have a hemorrhage.
No.
I think that's overblown, overthinking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Judy, in the meantime, get a CBC, check your ferritin levels, maybe if your iron is low.
Okay.
That would be a contributor, I think, first to brittle nails.
Thyroid problems as well can cause nail issues. I mean, so it, you know, there are a few things to look at. The nails do reflect various nutritional deficiencies. Biotin deficiency is also a possibility. You can use biotin to strengthen nails. I know that because a researcher named Hoffman discovered that.
Ah.
No relation.
Yeah. Speaking of biotin, I'm going to digress a little bit because I think it's important. I have a case study to talk about here. I had a woman come see me a few months back, and she was complaining of thinning hair. So she put herself on 10,000 micrograms of biotin every day.
I can almost guess what's about to happen, but go ahead.
Yeah. And then her thyroid tests came back a little wacky.
Yeah. That's where I was going with that.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So I said, you need to go back and see your endocrinologist, but stop taking the biotin immediately.
Yes.
Wait a few weeks.
Yes.
She went back, had the same thyroid panel. Mm-hmm. Everything came back normal.
Yep.
So we started looking at other things for her hair
right,
thinning.
Right.
But I said,
but, you know,
wow.
And there may be a threshold, but 10,000 is quite a lot.
It is.
And so, you know, it may be that she can take, 1,000. That might be okay. That's still 1,000 micrograms.
Now, I have a question about this. Hmm. High-dose biotin, pharmacological amounts of biotin
yeah.
may be good for multiple sclerosis.
Yes, very
high dose. How do we reconcile what it may do to thyroid?
No, it screws up the test. It doesn't hurt your thyroid.
It just screws up the test. That's different.
It's not suppressing.
It's not throwing them. It's not suppressing
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not throwing them into Graves' disease. It's just askew.
In the laboratory test for certain things like TSH, they use a biotin-avidin assay, where having so much biotin in your bloodstream changes the characteristic of the test.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes
yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
It's their assay.
Yeah, that's right.
That's
so it's not actually hurting your thyroid. It makes it appear that your thyroid is whacked out.
Mm.
But that's we have to, and maybe there's integrative practitioners who are listening in, is before you zealously treat somebody's thyroid, based on an abnormal test, maybe ask the question, are you taking high-dose biotin? Because I think biotin has such a reputation for hair, skin, and nails.
Yes.
A lot of people are taking a lot of biotin.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, rarely you'll get less commonly, people are taking biotin for multiple sclerosis. Those doses are, we're talking 30, 60,000 a day for MS.
Wow.
Yeah. And that'll really screw up the blood tests.
Wow. 30 to 60,000 micrograms. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's something.
Right.
I hope it works.
And it's pretty harmless nutrient. I know it doesn't have a problem.
Hmm.
All right. So at this point, let's take one more question before we pause.
Okay. We've got an email from Sue. I was told that I have to stop all of my supplements for 5 days before having a colonoscopy. Is that true?
Well, it's an interesting question because what could mess up a colonoscopy is the presence of particles in the intestine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The other thing that could mess up a colonoscopy is if you were very, very susceptible to bleeding, maybe that's the consideration. So, I really think that's overly cautious. I think I would follow when you're supposed to stop having solid food, I'd stop taking supplements.
Mm. Yeah.
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 As to the bleeding, I don't think anything that you're going to take as a supplement is so potent as an anticoagulant that it's going to cause you to have a susceptibility to hemorrhaging.
Yeah.
If there's like rough handling with the colonoscope in your intestine that nicks the wall of the intestine, or maybe they're going to do a biopsy and a biopsy is going to result in some bleeding.
Or remove a polyp.
Yeah. Which results in some bleeding. But,
yeah.
I guess a consideration might be really high-dose fish oil.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Ginkgo, garlic maybe.
Maybe, yeah.
A very high dose of vitamin E if you're currently...
Yeah.
Any aspirin, certainly.
Yeah, right.
If anything, I'd be more afraid of aspirin than before a procedure.
Yeah, so, look, there's a lot of those kind of recommendations. It's like, stop taking everything when you're taking chemo. Stop taking everything when you're taking radiation.
Mm-hmm.
Stop taking all supplements before surgery. All those are sort of blanket recommendations that need to be applied selectively. There's certain supplements that are either neutral or beneficial in those circumstances. Supplements for surgery, supplements that protect you from the harmful effects of chemo and don't interfere with the beneficial effects of chemo.
Yeah.
And same thing for radiation. So, but it's easier to just say stop everything. And besides, they believe it's junk anyway.
Yeah.
It's like worthless junk anyway. So stop all that worthless junk. We don't need it.
Mm.
Yes, that's basically the default.
Ignorance is bliss.
The default position on supplements.
Right.
Okay, good point at which to pause because we divided these podcasts into two parts. And Layla, give us a preview of what we're going to be tackling in part two.
been taking glucosamine chondroitin for prevention of arthritis, but should I also be taking collagen powder?
Okay, we'll tackle that question in part two. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman today with our nutritionist in residence, Layla Mutin, and we'll be back with more of this week's Intelligent Medicine broadcast. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla.